Hello everyone, it's April 2nd, 2024. The journal Nature published an interesting paper on what we might be able to do with the Orbital Reef Commercial Space Station, so we're going to break that down. And we also now know a few of the experiments going up on Artemis 3. We'll get into that too. But first, let's get the show up and lift off. And we've put the tower. Welcome to episode 453 of the Orbital Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
What's my line? Oh, right. I'm Ben.
And I'm Dennis.
Almost forgot, huh?
Yeah. So last week I was in Alabama, or the week before last I was in Alabama. Last week I was exhausted from traveling. This was travel for work. I flew in and out of Huntsville, but had to drive like an hour and a half to get to the town I was working in. And it was really killing me to go through Huntsville and not do anything spacey. But I had scheduled a full week of work. At first I was really hoping I was going to have a free Friday or half of Friday, but right before I left, they piled so much work into my lap. And so I was working with one of the members of the team who, was on like, medical light work. And so I was doing the physical stuff but I had somebody helping me. So, we worked really, really hard and we got this huge to-do list all the way done. The only things that we missed were some work that we had scheduled on Friday, and it was raining on Friday. So Thursday night, we were both looking at the weather forecast. We're like, nothing's getting done tomorrow. So I said, okay, well, let me take off early. I'm not going to come in on Friday. I'm just going to go straight to Huntsville. And I'll, you know, do some computer work while I'm there. I'm not just cutting out, but I was like, I'd like to go see some space stuff. So I'm effectively made a little bit of time in my schedule. I really would have liked to reach out to somebody, at Marshall, but because my schedule was so uncertain, like I really didn't think there was going to be a chance, I didn't. So instead I went to, the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, which is out by the airport out to the west. So I got to say, I was a little disappointed because I was expecting Udvar Hazy. And instead, it is more of a children's museum with a absolutely gigantic budget, huge budget. they have a space camp. And I think this is like the space camp, right? So it was like a $30 entry. And the place was just filled with kids. And I was like, okay, we'll see. But I'll tell you what, when I was driving from my hotel at the airport, which by the way, there's a hotel in the airport at the Huntsville airport. In the morning when I got up to get on my airplane, I literally took an elevator down and walked 50 feet to security. It was so cool. But I was driving from my hotel to the museum, and as I'm going down the highway, I go around a curve and suddenly there is a Saturn V on the horizon. And from my car, like half a mile away, that thing was bigger than I thought it was. I told you guys there was like a shocking takeaway for me, and this was it. Was the Saturn V is so much bigger than I thought it was. And I've seen Saturn V's before, but they were laying on their side and they didn't look as big. So then, you know, then they've got like this whole rocket garden. So once I get in, I'm able to walk up to the Saturn V. They've got one standing up, a replica standing up outside. And then they've got the Saturn V hull where they have a real one, not a flown Saturn V, but unflown parts that they've collected. And it's on its side and it feels a lot smaller. It's hanging way up in the air. You're not as close to it. It just doesn't feel the same. But the one standing up was so huge. And they also have a Saturn 1C there, a Saturn 1. And that thing was like, it's big, but it's not very big, standing next to a Saturn V. And I couldn't wrap my mind around how tall this thing really is. Seeing it standing up is unbelievable. This is shocking. The thing's a building. They also had an F1 standing upright. And I've seen F1s, but I've only seen them on their side. And an SSME. And so I wanted to see if I could find the pogo suppressor. This one didn't have one, but I was walking around the thing looking up at the plumbing, and it was pretty bright. You know, it was a cloudy sky. It was just starting to sprinkle. So I'm looking up and like, you know, it's hard to look into a cloudy sky, but I'm still like looking up and walking around the thing. And I'm just like, that plumbing section is so high off the ground. The thing is absolutely huge. But yeah, I mean, it's basically like a whole theme park. Really, really cool.
Orbital Reef. Yeah, so Dennis, I guess we have some, I don't know if we have new news on it, but it seems like there's some more well fleshed out plans, I guess, for Orbital Reef.
Yeah, I guess the news is that a couple days ago, Nature magazine, one of the real big, you know, science journals in the world, they published an open access article by six authors. Louis Zay is the lead author, and it's just about Orbital Reef and more generally about commercial LEO destinations, CLD program, but really just focusing on Orbital Reef because the authors are all the lead authors from Sierra Space and the rest are all from Blue Origin. And so, yeah, I thought it was pretty cool just in the sense that, you know, it was just kind of a recap of a lot of what we already kind of have known about Orbital Reef, but then some, a really, really diagram. There's only one figure in the article, and it's a really, really detailed diagram of the different modules that Orbital Reef will have. And even though this image has existed elsewhere, apparently it was presented at a space conference last year, but this is definitely the first time I'm seeing it. And I'm guessing this would be the first time a lot of people will see it. But yeah, I thought it'd be a cool little quick, rundown on what this space station, this commercial space station might end up looking like. And so just, kind of a recap, Orbital Reef is kind of headed by, Blue Origin. But the partnership involves them and a number of other companies kind of working together. Blue Origin, you know, wants to use the New Glenn launch vehicle with its larger fairing size to be able to take these, you know, components to orbit. Sierra Space would be providing their Dream Chaser space plane for both cargo and crew, while Boeing would also be providing Starliner for crew. And then there's also partnerships, you know, with Jeff Bezos involved. So Amazon, with their kind of supply chaining, they think that that can help make this station a reality just based on the logistics involved. Arizona State University is kind of leading a partnership of a bunch of universities to, I guess, you know, act as essentially consultants and participate in the station in that kind of way, maybe some others. And then there's also Genesis Engineering, which I learned what they're contributing to the station specifically, which is pretty neat. And I'm sure I'd heard about this at some point in the past, but I had forgotten, and I think it's pretty cool. And then Redwire, which is a company that is involved with a lot of things that are important, including the rollout solar arrays, I believe, through a number of Shinehart Wig Company kind of relationships are Redwire's kind of, you know, the company behind those, or at least part of the companies behind those. So in any event, it was now 3 years ago in 2021 that the Commercial LEO Destination Awards were given. And the three stations that got money, the three station concepts were Orbital Reef. And then the other two were Northrop Grumman, which doesn't have a name. And then NanoRacks's Starlab, which is a much smaller looking station. And one thing that I thought was interesting and left out, you know, I wouldn't really expect it in an article you want to publish in Nature, but there was reporting last fall that Sierra Space and Blue Origin were going to part ways because Blue kind of wanted to focus more on Blue Moon rather than Orbital Reef, while Sierra Space wanted to focus more on, I suppose, Dream Chaser or something rather than this station specifically. And so we'll see, you know, what ends up happening. Who knows? But what I thought was funny is that in all these papers about Orbital Reef, they talk about going with the term reef to kind of invoke, you know, a self-reinforcing ecosystem or one that can kind of just like, you know, grow. Or I saw at one point it was described as kind of like a refuge from like the harsher environments around there for a lot of sea creatures. But I don't know when, like, David and Ben, when you think of coral reefs, what's the first thing you think of this day and age?
I mean, probably like deforestation and the damage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think of bleaching and climate change destroying them. Yeah. But whatever. That's a branding choice.
And a reef is something that you can shipwreck on too. So
yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, still, it's a nice name.
It is. Orbital Reef is a pretty cool name for a potential space station. Much cooler than a name like calling it like the Orbital Commercial Park or the Orbital Mixed Use Commercial Park. That would be, much less nice of a name. But yeah. So what is the reef? So their original plan is to have four pressurized modules and then the kind of external power and heat rejection kind of mast. But yeah, so this is where this image, figure one in the paper, is really, really cool and kind of shows you what they envision. And so the idea is to have a core module taken up in a single launch by, a New Glenn. And it has about 250 cubic meters of volume, which is about one third of the ISS. And so it's got the cylindrical shape. It can support up to 10 crew. It would serve as essentially the hub and like the backbone. You could send up multiple of these to, build out the station, like a reef, I suppose. And it also would be kind of, I guess, where the brains are for command and control, for data processing, for communications with the ground, all that kind of good stuff. And it's also where the mast system with the power and the radiators would be. But I'll talk about that in a bit. And it could support up to 10 crew, the way they're designing it. And one thing is that it would have six really, really big windows that are kind of on the belly of it, aimed, at the nadir towards Earth. And so they would be aligned kind of two rows of three, or two columns of three windows each. And so that would be something pretty awesome, because there is that version of a cupola that would have these absolute massive windows that – what company is working on that? I can't remember. My apologies to them. But in any event, these would also be just absolute massive windows and pretty cool. And then branching off of that core module to, what would be radial ports is how you would build out the station from that core. And so there's also a research module, which is similar in size and shape. And that would be something that could be totally customized potentially by a customer. But ultimately, upshot is, you have a lot of internal payloads being hosted on what they call mid-deck equivalent racks, MDEs. And so, just a lot of racks everywhere. Have some external platforms that kind of remind me of the Japanese experiment module, and then also a science cupola / airlock. So a little combo there where you not only have the awesome cupola kind of views, but you could also have an airlock. And I'm assuming, and maybe this is not a good assumption, but the figure shows the cupola at the top of the image of the research module, and it shows the mast that, again, has the power, the solar panels and radiators at the bottom. So I'm guessing this image is flipped, essentially, that the Earth would be would be up relative to this image, and space would be down. Yeah, just based on those two, you wouldn't want the cupola necessarily aimed at, space, and your radiators aimed back, or not, aimed at the Earth, but on the, the nadir side of the module, so, or the station, so. But yeah, that's branching out on one direction, and then branching out the other way from the core is the LIFE module, which is the Large Integrated Flexible Environment. And so this is one of these inflatable ones that we've been seeing that has been just recently had a burst test with some really cool images and videos associated with that.
And it was a very successful one. I think it burst at way above the required limit. Mm. So it actually exceeded the design requirements. So they did well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they were supposed to design to four times the maximum operating pressure, and then they even exceeded that. So yeah. Now keep in mind there's LIFE, but there's also Bigelow's inflatable module, and I think we talked about that burst test specifically on air. I don't know if we talked about LIFE's, but there's a couple inflatable things that are getting popped on the ground right now, and so just want to keep those straight. But yeah. But LIFE, as its name might invoke, is kind of the habitation quarters. And so it's even larger than the core research modules, so 300 cubic meters. and you just kind of have everything in the kitchen sink in there. So it could host payloads as well, not nearly as many as the research module would, but it would have, you know, you could have research facilities in there, sleeping quarters for 10 people, multiple commodes, what they call a health and hygiene compartment, exercise equipment, and plant growing hardware. And so, I mean, this thing's quite large.
Yeah, it looks really spacious. Although I wonder, once it's fully equipped and, you know, like, how much free space would there really be?
Good question. Yeah.
Because I can see it getting cluttered up really quickly again. Uh-huh. That's just how space stations probably will be.
Yeah. And life, it looks like they're trying to slice up life into, like, you know, having a main kind of alleyway with a couple branching off areas. So it's not like just a giant empty space. Where the research module really does look like it just, you know, maybe they split it in two, maybe they have that kind of like a floor in between, but there's a lot more free space in any given volume of the core and the research module compared to life, where it looks like life, they're kind of maximizing, like I said, yeah, you know, bedrooms and commodes and such.
So Dennis O in the chat asks, is life related in any way to Beam? And I got to think the answer is yes, because like Sierra would have bought, or what would have hired folks out of Bigelow when Bigelow closed, at least. But I don't know of any direct connections, especially like with the initial designs. But I mean, probably a lot of, you know, common, what's it called? Convergent evolution kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then people working on it. So I don't think you can say that they're unrelated, but.
No, that's exactly what my instinct would have been. Yeah. Cause I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if they're, the difference between formally related versus, you know, lessons learned on one being incorporated into another.
Yeah, like I think you'd have to see purchase of IP when Bigelow went under. And I don't know if that happened. Like I haven't seen anything one way or the other.
Yeah. And then finally, there is the node, which for being a node, I guess it's more of like a spacecraft node and not really locking more modules onto it. And so this thing is smaller, about 40 cubic meters. It has two docking ports, International Docking System Standard, IDSS ones, and also has an airlock for the crew to do, you know, or for anybody to do EVAs if needed, as well as, I guess it also counts as an EVA. They could do traditional EVAs, or they can use what Genesis Engineering is adding to the mix and hop in their single-person spacecraft. Which is the idea is that's the a shirt sleeve environment in there, so you don't have to do pre-breathing, you don't have to do a lot of the stuff. Your arms aren't locked in, you know, your spacesuit's torso, you know, like you're not locked in the spacesuit in the same sense. But it's really just a you know, you just have like a big window in front of you and a couple like robotic claws and you know, arms that you can use to kind of grab stuff and float around, and it looks like it would have a little jetpack and everything. So it's a pretty neat concept, this single person spacecraft. Whether or not Orbital Reef ends up actually launching, this would be pretty cool to see fly. But I think last time when we did talk about it, it reminds me a lot of in the movie Inner Space, when Dennis Quaid is shrunk and injected into Martin Short's body. And so he's microscopic. And in any event, the bad guy goes in there in his own little, looks like a single-person spacecraft, and attacks them and ends up, spoiler alert, falling into they're fighting in the stomach, and he lands in some of the digestive acids in the gut and dies.
I forgot like all about that, and you're just reminding me. Yeah, I can see the images in my head. Yeah,
such a good movie. Yeah. So yeah, and so those are the four like pressurized modules that meatbags can be inside. But in addition, there's also the mast. Which has, you know, solar panels for electricity generation, 60 kilowatts electrical power, and then some radiators for radiating away 90 kilowatts of heat. But obviously there's, you know, there's a lot of like cool little nitty gritty details about everything. But the upshot is that if they start with these modules, and again, like you were saying, they would basically get to ISS size in kind of one go, or, you know, just one chaining of these together, then you can add another core along the long axis of the core module. And then from there have, you know, more of these research modules, life modules, even third party ones could be designed and, you know, built if anybody's interested, and kind of grow in that regard. And they do welcome other, you know, spacecraft to come visit. They even, you know, call out existing ones like, you know, dragons if they ever want to come. They also reference co-orbiting free flyers that can basically come and tag along. And I don't know if you know, something about having your free flying experiment just somewhere in the vicinity of Orbital Reef and then be able to do, you know, experiments or tests just by having, I guess, an external view of your spacecraft. And that, you know, is something that can be done. But at the end of the day, who knows what's actually going to pan out when it comes to this. But that would be super cool. I really would love to see this thing actually get put on orbit and do what it's supposed to do, because it's a pretty massive looking. Like I said, like the volume might be about the same as the ISS, but it's not long and stringy. It's, you know, it's chunky. It's a much less cramped inside. Until, again, maybe they put in so much equipment and stuff, it does become cramped. But
yep. So let's translate on over to a new topic. We got two this week. So Artemis 3 now has three experiments. I thought we'd talk briefly about that. There's not a whole lot to know just yet. It's just been announced. But just a cursory glance at what's going on here. And so this is for launch in, what, 2026? That's the idea. There's a couple of things that these three – well, there's one main thing that these three experiments all have in common. They were all chosen because – they had to be installed by humans. Maybe this means that they were looking for experiments that only, not that only a person could do, but that actually required human intervention, just because, like, you know, why not take advantage of that fact because you're going to have people on the moon? Right. Or maybe it was just, you know, these were three, they were at the top of the list because you had to have people. And so go ahead and get that out of the way. Perhaps that's the reason why. I'm not sure.
Right. Well, I mean, you think about it, right? If there was something that you could just send on a CLPS mission, then why, you know, take valuable Artemis 3 space?
Exactly. Yeah, so that's why I'm thinking pick something that, you know, like really needs people involved. But yeah, and so they were also chosen to meet the Artemis science objectives, which the three main points here are, since this is a mission going to the South Pole, understanding the planetary processes and origin of the polar volatiles and mitigating exploration risks. Those are the three main things. And so the three experiments that were chosen, the first one is called LEAF, Lunar Effects on Agricultural Flora. So this is some kind of a, and I couldn't find much on this, this is some kind of a plant experiment, and it basically means that you're growing plants on the moon, but that doesn't, you know, tell us much because obviously you're not planting it in regolith. Yeah, so I don't know what kind of protection as far as, like, you know, things like the radiation environment are going to have, but that is something that is going to be monitored, and also how they grow in partial gravity. But I would like to know more about, you know, just some more details, but definitely the partial gravity is going to be pretty easy. As far as the radiation goes, I, you know, don't know if they're going to be restricting a lot of that. I suppose something that's similar to what people would be inhabiting, and then seeing, you know, how the plants fare. Because the idea is, see if maybe some, there are some plants that can be used for actually feeding people who live on the lunar base. So that is one of the objectives. So I suppose a lot of, you know, food type plants, things of that sort. So apparently, like Chang'e 4, they did, you know, sprout seeds on the far side of the moon, but that was not a full life cycle. They didn't do too well. So hopefully things will be better this time. So the idea is to get, you know, like an idea of a full life cycle, you know, a little bit beyond the sprouting seed stage. We can assume that since it requires people, you know, like you can sort of factor that into exactly what this might look like, because you could just land something kind of like Chang'e did. You could put something on the moon that can grow a plant. But this requires humans. So again, this really makes me wonder exactly what this is going to look like. I guess larger in scope and a little bit more ambitious. But yeah, and the next one is the LEMS, which is the Lunar Environment Monitoring Station. And this is basically kind of like a series of seismometers and some other things. And it's designed to operate from 3 months to 2 years. So that's a pretty big gap there. The idea, I think the objective is 2 years, but maybe just 3 months. I'm not sure why. I don't know if that's because they haven't been able to characterize the durability of this particular, you know, this particular experiment. But the idea is to characterize the regional structure of mantle and crust. And it uses something called the Molecular Electronic Transducer. This measures moonquakes. And I thought this was pretty interesting. I don't know if this is how quakes are monitored now, but it uses a special kind of electrochemical cell which senses the movement of electrolytes between two electrodes. And I don't know if that's, again, if that's something that's normally how, you know, we detect quakes here on Earth, but I thought that was kind of neat.
I was going to say, Don't Panic Geocast has a whole episode, which is really great, dedicated to seismometers. And so maybe that should be one worth a listen.
Yeah, yeah. And then the other experiment that is part of LEMS is called the QMS, which is the Quadrupole Mass Spectrometer. Apparently, this is the exact same mass spectrometer that was on the LADEE and the MAVEN missions. And then the third actual payload or experiment is the Lunar Dielectric Analyzer. And this measures the lunar regolith's ability to propagate any electric field. So basically, you know, trying to measure the dielectric effect. So basically, I think the idea is you get a sense of that, and they're looking for things like water, or I guess more specifically ice, if you have a good sense of I forget what the term is.
The potential.
You mean capacitance?
Oh, it's actually called permittivity.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Which is the term that I had.
Which is pretty close to Mike's guess of impedance.
Kind of the same. Impedance. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's probably a term that I would be much more familiar with. Impedance. Kind of similar. And yeah, and so I think the idea is if you have some idea of the characteristics of ice, maybe that tells you something. And then also, this is also compared with measurements that have been taken of the lunar regolith, both from orbit, because this is something that can be done with synthetic aperture radar. I guess the experiments that have been done on the regolith that has been brought back. And so maybe make a comparison with what's being found there on the surface, and you can get some idea. And so I guess it's kind of like ground truthing the synthetic aperture radar, because, I mean, this is something that's already been done from the satellites. But I suppose this is going to be a little bit more effective. But yeah, I mean, it seems that mostly for the interests of setting up a moon base, it's about finding the presence of ice, because it seems that that's what, you know, like everyone keeps talking about, like when it comes to the Artemis 3 mission, or I guess Artemis in general.
Well, one other application might be looking at whether you could use arc smelting to melt regolith. But I suspect that because people have already looked into using microwaves to sinter the regolith into a hard brick. Like that seems like that's way better of a way to dump heat energy into the regolith. But like, I mean, who knows? Like if we found that, you know, there were parts of the regolith that was, you know, there were patches that were actually pretty good at conducting electricity, like maybe arc smelting might make sense. Seems kind of far-fetched, but...
We'll find out exactly why in the future, but there's not a whole lot just now. And to top that, these three experiments might not necessarily fly on Artemis 3, so that's actually not guaranteed. That is where they're being allocated for right now, but there is like final manifesting that, you know, is still pending. So that could change. They could put it on some other mission. Who knows? And also, they don't have an exact landing site, except that it's going to be somewhere around the South Pole, obviously, you know, the Southern Polar region. That's as much as we know right now.
So are they leaving the monitoring station on the moon?
Lunar Environment Monitoring Station? Yeah, that one. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Because it's kind of interesting that they would send a mass spec when, like, you could take samples and go home. But if they're leaving it there over time, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, I would say 3 months to 2 years, so they have to leave it to get that kind of baseline.
Yeah.
So if it's described, the LEMS is a compact autonomous seismometer suite designed to carry out long-term continuous monitoring of the seismic environment. If the QMS is part of that, then I figure that's part of a compact autonomous suite that's going to do continuous long-term monitoring. So.
Okay, so let's just do two short and sweets this week. Dennis, what is the first one?
A rotating detonation rocket engine flies for the first time. Venus Aerospace, under the guidance of DARPA, has successfully tested a rotating detonation rocket engine, or RDRE, on a winged drone measuring 8 feet, or 2.4 meters long, and weighing 300 pounds, or 136 kilograms. After being carried to 12,000 feet on an undisclosed aircraft, the drone was dropped and the RDRE engine was fired, reaching a top speed of Mach 0.9. Venus Aerospace is developing the engine, which has a significant efficiency gain compared to traditional engines, to power its Stargazer spaceplane, designed for crewed point-to-point travel anywhere on Earth in under an hour. Hat tip to Andrew Z for putting this on our radar.
Next, a nascent solution for Voyager 1. Voyager became non-communicative this month, sending back a repeating pattern of ones and zeros instead of the usual data packets. The team deduced that the issue was in the Flight Data Subsystem, or FDS, which collects and packets data before handing it off to the antenna subsystem. A slightly garbled memory dump was recovered, and it suggests that part of a memory bank has failed. In order to avoid that section of memory, the team must figure out how to reprogram the 46-year-old spacecraft and move about half a megabyte of software to a different region of memory. NASA is now hopeful that the vehicle can be recovered.
I was not expecting that. That's so, I'm happy.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on to This Week in Spaceflight History. You just got three winners. We have Dennis O. Then we have two other winners who also got the bonus points, and they were Hydrek and the Greeks. So congratulations. The clue was catching geoworms, which I joked was sounded like some kind of a disease, but I'm assuming it wasn't. So yeah, Ben, take it away. What are geoworms?
Yeah. Okay. So This Week in Spaceflight History is the 6th of April, 1965. It was the launch of IntelSat 1, the first commercial satellite in GEO. And the detail here is commercial because I'm going to tell you about the first communication satellite in GEO in a second. So let's get straight to the clue. IntelSat 1 was nicknamed Early Bird. So Early Bird catches the worm in GEO, catching geoworms. So IntelSat 1 was launched from Launch Complex 17A at the Cape. And it launched on a Delta D rocket. It was based on the SINCOM satellites that NASA had launched, I guess, 2 years before in 1963. They launched three of them, SINCOM 1, 2, and 3, on a Thor Delta B for the first two and a Thor Delta D for the third one. And the SINCOM satellites were just like a proof of concept kind of thing. They were capable of a single two-way phone connection or 16 teletype connections. So SINCOM 1 really unfortunately had an electrical failure just after it finished circularizing its orbit. Like it shuts down its engines and goes, okay, bye, and is dead, and we never hear from it again. SINCOM 2 then became the first communication satellite in geosynchronous orbit, and just barely took the title away from IntelSat 1. And then SINCOM 3 also made it up. All three of them were actually transferred over to DoD after NASA had finished doing their proof of concept testing. And it's kind of interesting because DoD already owned the U.S. Department of Defense. They already owned the ground stations that NASA was using to talk to these satellites anyway. So, you know, I suspect that they knew ahead of time that they were going to be picking up some communication satellites. So after Hughes made these three SINCOM satellites, they basically turned around and started making one for the to sell to a commercial partner rather than NASA. And so IntelSat was, like I said, based on the SINCOM satellites, but it was definitely upgraded. So it could, you know, relay a whole TV signal, which is pretty cool. Or it could do 240 one-way phone connections, so 120 two-way phone conversations, as opposed to the single two-way phone connection that SINCOM 2 and 3 were capable of. I really wanted to compare this to a modern communication satellite, but it doesn't really make sense because all of our modern satellites are digital and IntelSat was analog. So we can talk about its bandwidth. It's got, I think, 50 megabytes or megahertz of bandwidth, but like there's no real good way to translate that to a digital comparison. But I mean, if you think about 120 one-way phone connections compared to all of the HD satellite TV signals and internet communications, like everything, I guess we don't do that much internet going up to GEO, but it is done. It's a huge amount of data that we've gone up to today. And even this first jump was pretty big, but it only goes up from there, right? It's not terribly surprising. This thing was actually really small. I mean, when you think about like Tedris, which has those two giant insect looking parabolic reflectors that multiple people, like you could have a whole crowd of people using them as a hammock at one time, taking a nap in them. Like they're just huge. This guy, on the other hand, it's a cylinder. So it's about 2.5 feet by 2 feet. So 2.5 feet in diameter, 2 feet tall. That's 76 by 61 ish centimeters. Really, really tiny. And similarly, it was very light. It was about 39 kilograms or 86 pounds dry. And then it pretty much doubled that in fuel, at launch when it's full. So really, really tiny satellite, really tiny, throughput. it's kind of a cute start to our reliance on space for communications.
Especially since there was such a development, like where GEO suddenly became, I guess, big birds over time. And only more recently, it's actually newsworthy that they're trying to send modest sized satellites to GEO once again.
Yeah. IntelSat-1 was planned to be in operation for 18 months, which is also a great contradiction to the way that we do things today. 18 months and then the thing is done is just unheard of. That's unacceptable for today's standards. But that was its planned operational life. It actually was active for 4 years and 4 months before they shut it down for the first time. It actually came back online for an additional 2 months so that it could help with the Apollo 11 broadcasts. So a total of 5.5 years of life, which still will be shocking today. But yeah, there you go. That's this week in spaceflight history.
I was trying to see if I could find any of our photos when we went to Udvar-Hazy ourselves, because it was donated there. Oh, but it was donated to there in 2022. So we missed it.
We were which there before.
I think IntelSat-1, the early bird.
Well, I mean, it's still in GEO right now.
Oh, the flight test model. Sorry.
The flight test model. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I was like, I know it's not that, but what alternative is it? Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you for that, Ben. Always interesting to hear about very early satellites. David, you're up. next week is the 9th to the 15th of April. Do you have a clue for us?
Yes. So next week in 2006, the mission that went to hell in 5 months.
Okay.
That's your clue.
I have no idea, and I'm looking forward to finding out because it sounds like a shame. Or maybe that's some kind of weird pun or something. I don't know. But
could be.
Yeah, right? So if you have a guess as to what this clue is referencing, email us at info@theorbitalmechanics.com or shoot us a tweet on Mastodon using the hashtag ThisWeekSF or visit theorbitalmechanics.com/Discord for an invite to our Discord server. Good luck, everybody.
Good luck. All right, so let's move on to upcoming spaceflight events. Then we got 5 events. A couple of them are launches. What's the first maybe launch, Ben?
All right. So first up is a Long March 2C launching who knows what. This is coming purely out of the NOTAMs that have been published. So it might not even be a Long March 2C. We'll see. But that's going to be flying on Tuesday, April the 2nd, according to the NOTAM, sometime between 2247 hours UTC and 2312 hours UTC.
And then next up on April 3rd, we have NASA TV doing a reveal. And so this is specifically for the Artemis Lunar Terrain Vehicle Selection. And so they'll be having a news conference. Presumably, we will announce what companies are going to build this thing, which is, or at least, you know, they'll down select possibly building this thing. This is right the vehicle big enough for humans to actually get on and drive around on the lunar surface.
So it's the Lunar Rover Mark II.
Yeah, Lunar Rover Mark II. Good way to put it. And so a lot of the usual suspects, Lockheed, Northrop, Leidos, and NASCAR are bidding for it. But in any event, yeah. So
does NASCAR build vehicles?
Maybe they ask Leidos to do it for them. I don't know.
Maybe it's like a collection of the people who build NASCAR cars, like GM or something.
Because they are doing it in partnership with Leidos, but I don't know. We'll have to see.
I mean, it's kind of like FIFA bidding to build an inflatable module, right? Like,
right.
Y'all don't even make foot or soccer balls. Like, what? You're FIFA. Come on. That's funny.
So again, that's all going to be Wednesday, April 3rd at 4 p.m. Eastern time on NASA TV.
And then next up on NASA TV, NASA TV heavy week, on the 5th, we have the coverage of the farewells and hatch closure for the Soyuz MS-24. And that starts at 8 p.m. The hatch closure is scheduled for approximately 8:26 p.m. And then looks like later on that day will be the undocking coverage for that spacecraft. And that starts at 11:30 p.m. And then the undocking itself is scheduled for 11:55 p.m. And that's Eastern time. Yeah, so they'll be in there for just a couple of hours before they push off. So that's good.
Next up is a Falcon 9 Block 5 launching Bandwagon 1. Such a great name. Bandwagon is SpaceX's new mid-inclination rideshare program. So this is going to be a bunch of tiny satellites all hitching a ride to the same deployment location, I guess. So somewhere around 45 degrees. I'm not sure what the exact inclination is for this, but it's, you know, above zero and below 90. Some of the payloads on board are Capella Space's Acadia 4, and then also a vehicle from the South Korean government called 425 Project Flight 2, which, boy, is a super Googleable name. So Bandwagon 1 is going to be flying on Sunday, April 7th at 23:17 hours UTC.
And then finally, on April 8th, we have the total solar eclipse over North America. So for those of you in Mexico, in the United States, or in the kind of southeastern little tips of Canada, come check out this eclipse. It should be a biggie. I've never seen a total before, but I hear that they are literally life-changing. And so, when it begins, it's going to be in the afternoon, pretty much, except maybe if you're on the west coast of Mexico. I'm not sure exactly when it starts for you there, but in any event, it's going to be during the day. That's how solar eclipses work. And be sure to be safe. And remember, this is what I've heard, and I mean, it makes absolute sense, is that, you know, it's not much of a difference between, well, the difference between 99% covered versus 100% in totality is all the difference in the world. And so you really, if you have the opportunity to go see totality, try to make it all the way to that path and don't settle for 99% if you're able to get to 100, because the sun's really bright. So 1% is still going to be quite bright.
All right. So those are your upcoming spaceflight events.
All right. So that means it's time to do with the show. And we would like to thank Ron Jakezy and Tim Dodd for our music.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com.
We record live on Sundays at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. Thank you so much to Mike, Dennis O., Mr. Cesium, Chris S., Hara Gopal, The Greek, and Colin for joining our recording session today and helping us make correction burns on the fly.
And if you want to support the show, please tell a friend, or better yet, just leave us a review wherever you listen. You can also visit theorbitalmechanics.com/support for our Patreon campaign and affiliate links.
Get in touch. Find links to our mailing list, Discord server, and Mastodon account at theorbitalmechanics.com/about. Or you can skip all of that by emailing info@theorbitalmechanics.com.
So that's it. We'll see you all next week on Orbit. Until then, later.
Goodbye, everybody.
See you.